Let's begin our board meeting. I welcome everybody here. Let's go around the table and do just a quick round of introductions.
I'm Linda Alderman. I'm not as dense as I seem.
I'm Brent.
He is as dense as he seems.
I was going to say that.
Oh.
I'm Paul Brayden.
Jody Akers, lot 128.
Sunshine Harris, John's other half.
Donna Cox.
John Harris.
Ed Polinsky.
Murray Burr.
Dave Turner.
Dale Clarkson. And Dark Flesh. Okay, we appreciate everybody coming, and we'll jump right down through the agenda. Does everybody have an agenda?
I know,
item number two, welcome Dave Turley. Do you want to say anything about yourself? Tell us your history and why you're here and what you hope to see happen and stuff like that?
No, but I will. I said plenty. I'm usually a man of few words, but I did say plenty when I did the election before the election. And so I'm happy to be here. Hope I can serve well and work as a good team player and make some more things happen than I so get enough to be.
We're happy that you're here. Decision on meeting minutes responsibility. So Dave, I think unless we change things, you're kind of over communication stuff, at least was the default position that you're kind of filling.
Okay.
Unless somebody else feels otherwise inclined, and if you're willing to do that, that would be good.
I've been volunteered for things before, so this is good.
Okay, we should be approving last meeting minutes, but I don't know that anybody has them here with us, but I think they were
sent. They were online.
So if we could have a motion on that.
No motion.
Add motions to approve the minutes.
And I'll second it.
Shauna seconds. Mm-hmm. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. In opposition. Okay. I just had this item number five, review of responsibilities here. This is what we have assigned, and in theory, Dave, you would take item G, ranch communications, reservations, web development. I don't know if you feel like that's a good match or you want to, or if anybody wants to kind of change some of the assignments as they are.
I don't have any expertise in any of these areas, although I'm a quick learner, but I have been following emails. I've been dashing back and forth on this, at least the reservations and then the communications. And so I would be either way.
What if we amended that to ranch communication, reservation, web development, and roofing?
That is one thing I thought I'm qualified as doing. That's for sure.
Noted.
Another problem solved.
All right. I think there is some quite a bit of things that we want to look at as far as how we make reservations, how we work through that. You've seen some of the recent emails on it. I think we're just barely starting to say, hey, what should we do?
Yeah.
And so
nobody knows better than you.
Okay. Vance Green is a super resource on that, and I think we'll do about anything you assign. While you're over these, it doesn't necessarily mean you need to do them, but you're at least the person that's kind of making sure that somebody is on top of it and looking forward. Okay. Financial reports, I think you all have in front of you Linda's financial reports, two reports, a balance sheet, and a budget.
Is there an extra? I need one too.
I made seven copies. I think you already have.
Okay, so, John, being over finance, ought to have one?
I do, at least have one, yeah.
Okay, so let's start by looking at the balance sheet. And we'll have Linda augment things as we need to. But going down the from the top down, DSROA caretaker's account.
That's the function account for Paul and Nancy Brayton.
And so that account has now been reconciled, entered into the computer, all the data. That's a change since last meeting's. We probably have things that Paul has written checks for that haven't been entered, and we'll start to get to where we are about a week behind in that. And so in theory, some of the things that we've done, we've asked Paul to start using checks rather than the debit card. And in his checkbook, there's all the checks that we have are duplicate checks, carbonless copies. And so basically every week as I meet with Paul or Paul comes into town, he'll take and rip out the checks that that he's written, give those to Linda. Linda will enter those. Then when we get the bank statement, it's pretty easy to go down through and reconcile checks. It's very difficult to reconcile credit card charges and all of those kind of things as compared to checks. So there are a few cases, like Paul went to some training and had a motel bill or a meal bill where he's in a different town that may not take a local check. And so there are a few times where we felt like the debit card would still be of use. But everything that can be is going to be going to checks or billed via invoice so that we put a little bit more integrity into our accounting system. So in any case, that's what that count is. And basically, that's set up so that Paul and Nancy have a checking account that as they're conducting business that they can move forward and write checks, and as needed, then we transfer money out of the main fund into there. The next account, overpayment from last year, we don't have a clue what that is. Next Tuesday, we're meeting with John Clarkson, has helped us some with reconciling these. He's a CPA, and I think basically there were some general ledger items that that is money that's not necessarily there. It just shows on our balance statement, but we'll trace it all down and figure out what's going on with that. So it's apparently been on there for all the time that Linda's.
Yeah.
So it was something that was created
before. I went back to 2004 last night trying to figure out where it comes from, and it still is showing that there's no, it doesn't say where it's coming from.
It's no probably something that we don't want to have on there.
We will get it off next year. Okay.
The state bank account, I think that's all being reconciled correctly. Mm-hmm. And is our main account, so we can look at that and have some good integrity there. The capital improvement account, we should have a separate account, especially remember next year we're going to try to accrue in our assessments so much for capital improvements and so much for expenses so that we avoid being taxed on capital improvements. And so when we get that money in, we'll split it and put that much into that account and that much into the other one. We may need to get a separate checking account so we write the checks out separately, but for now that's a savings account, and that is reconciled, right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's how much it's in there.
And then the DSROA bunkhouse fund, Is that really an account?
It's a checking account on hold. We're just not using it as $100.
So that's probably the account that we'll start using then for the capital improvements account.
We established the funds to build a new house.
That was a donation, wasn't it?
It was all donation.
Yeah. So we'll reclassify this to be the capital account since it already has a checking account associated with it. And in theory, savings, do we get any interest rate on that?
7.5%.
So what we ought to do is put basically our money into savings and then transfer it into the checking account where we get no interest. So we'll kind of look at tuning up some of those strategies. So basically our current cash assets are probably about $31,000, given that this $2,000 is just an accounting entry versus anything that we can tag any money to. And so we're in pretty good shape going into the end of the year compared to, I think, previous years. We have made some commitments that have not yet had checks issued, quite a few large ones with the metal restoration. There's $7,500 there. We have another $500 or $600 for seeds for Johnson. We just filled diesel tanks and propane tanks that are going to be about $6,000 for those together. So a lot of this is already pretty well tied to something. But I think we're still going to have enough money to keep the lights on through the end of the year. Accounts.
Some of this reflects, there's two or three assessments for next year that have already been paid. So some of this reflects our next year's income also.
Okay. So we still are kind of tying out the accounts receivable. I think we're making a lot of progress on that, but we still have some issues that we need to resolve there, so I won't go into a lot of detail in that. So, and the other items on this balance sheet, I would say, unfortunately, are not really representative of anything. Well, for example, we say buildings. If we look at our other assets, we have our equipment, our land, and vehicles. I don't think any of those.
That
numbers.
Hasn't been entered. No.
I didn't even think so. When I did some work with Niall, who's doing our taxes, and basically our taxes. Are not being tied back to our QuickBooks account at the moment. And so he's kind of taken the information from the QuickBooks account, done our taxes, but not reconciled anything back into the QuickBooks account. So it doesn't give us a very financially accurate statement here, but I think mainly we're trying to be on top of what's happening with our cash flows and our assessments and getting those all reconciled, and Linda's been making a lot of progress there. So any other questions about the balance sheet? Okay, the profit and loss year to date, this is a standard format that I've asked to be put together, and I just want to talk about the format a little bit right now. Each of you will have some financial issues that you probably will be looking at next year, but this should be a format that would work good, where the first column is the budget that we put in. The second, the first column is the spending year to date. So even though it says January through December, you know, obviously we haven't taken a time warp into December and come back yet. So it's just a year to date. And then the budget for the year, And then you can see basically the delta on the budget and the percentage of the budget that is associated with that. So I'd like to kind of set aside down towards the end of the agenda, we have where we're going to work on our budget session. We'll want to have this handy and review that in detail then, and maybe not go over a lot of detail in it right now. Does that sound okay?
Good point.
So our two standard reports we'll start seeing every meeting, and as we look at them every meeting, it ought to give us a lot better feel of what's going on financially in the ranch. Okay, next item on the agenda, and I'm going to substitute this agenda around just a little bit if I can, because of totally selfish reasons. We have kids at home that are probably tearing the place apart, and if my wife can get there sooner instead of later, that would be a good thing. And so I put her towards the end of the agenda, but if nobody objects, I'd like to have her do her part now, if that's all right.
Okay. Thank you for letting me take a few minutes of your time. I have an architectural design background, and so I'm here to talk about a proposal for the Royal Finley Cabin, possible restoration. First of all, just to propose to the board, the question, is there an interest and or support for researching the feasibility of restoring this Finley Cabin that's in the meadow? And if so, what degree of support for full restoration to shore up and stabilize the remaining upright portions and clean up the debris and erect some kind of a pole, low fence around it to kind of set it apart and protect it, or just to remove the remains and build a replica or some combination of any of those possibilities. The full cost of restoration of something like this would be determined pending more research on what finding materials that would match the remaining parts, and also completion of classes that Snow College offers through this Traditional Building Skills Institute. They offer log cabin restoration and traditional wood window repair or restoration. I'm just going to leave this information here if anybody's interested in looking more at that. An effort would be made to minimize the additional cost to DSROA through written requests for donations to the Finley family, and possible donations from DSR members, pursuit of Utah Heritage Foundation grants and other like sources, and by coordination of volunteer labor and project workday schedules. So part of this proposal will be requesting that $6,000 be approved and earmarked in the 2010 budget for $1,000 or less to cover tuition, required books and class materials for me to attend the two workshops. Each workshop is a 3-day workshop. And then the $5,000 plus the balance remaining from the first amount to cover a portion of restoration, construction materials, and hard costs that would be documented by receipt, like I said. And there's no, at this point in time, no way I can propose a budget without some research to know what, you know, if if the first full restoration option was voted on, what that would cost, it would require, putting the budgeted amount towards it and then working for it from there. And then final question, is there interest in preservation, restoration of any of the other historic buildings on there, that's like the old barn or the hidden cabin. So that's my proposal. Leave it for you guys to consider.
And you're not letting off that easy.
What I've just gone over, I didn't have enough copies, so you'll have to fight.
When it gets down to doing the budget, I think what Loretta's asking for is that we set aside about $6,000 to work on this project. My guess is, if you wanted to have that cabin fully restored, you'd pay $70,000 or $80,000. So I don't think there's any way that we can hire it done. However, if she takes these classes and we have some money that will cover materials and maybe some volunteer efforts, and maybe she can get some historical grants funds to supplement the activities, maybe we can get $20,000 to $30,000 worth of value out of $5,000 or $6,000 worth of our commitment and support. We may do part of it 1 year, part of it next year, but I think one of the key things is for her to go to the class, which is about $600, and or maybe $700 or $800 by the time there's the course materials in, so that we would be able to see what we can realistically do and what, is recommended there. And I'm hoping at that class that she would find some connections that would help us with some funding sources. But the Finley Cabin is the, it's the one right by the meadow. Everybody knows where it is. We probably should have brought some pictures to remind us what it looks like now. But, it was a pretty impressive cabin, and also the hidden cabin. How many, by a show of hands, have hiked around the hidden cabin? So, those are two, pretty nice pieces of history that I think we ought to at least evaluate and put some commitment towards. And we probably have to prioritize it when we get to the end of our meeting here, and we have 80 items that we want to do and only enough money and energy to do 15. We'll see how it stacks up with the rest, but I think it has some significant historical value to the ranch and something that would at least be worth starting some efforts on.
Is there a way we could get to the Forest Service and harvest the logs? We have to get the dead logs anyway, even come close to matching the sidewise. Especially with all the dead timber around.
The forest is dead logs only, and the BLM is real easy to get logs from, but probably wouldn't find too many that would, be a good match. Larry and Dale and I went up there and kind of hunted around and looked at it, and a lot of the logs are still there, but the whole roof structure is, I don't know if any of it can really be reused, but, if we could get the walls solid enough and maybe then build even a new roof structure, it probably wouldn't be, restoration-wise.
We get the logs and stuff and saw them for the roof structure.
Well, the only thing you really need for the roof structure is the shingles to make it look like
the whole roof was framed with...
Right.
The only visible part would be the shingles. Right. So if you had new construction for the structure...
Yeah. I'm not suggesting we put roof trusses on it, but we could stick build...
We could use the logs that we could harvest if we could get the proper permits.
Right. See, Alder Hoof, as near as I can tell, was dimensioned lumber.
Right.
You know, so...
Rough
so
side, most likely. Mm-hmm.
It, and some of it is maybe still good and usable, but it wouldn't be something that I would feel is a violation to the intent of the building to put new dimensioned lumber in places where we have to, even if we couldn't, rough cut things, as long as it was stuff that showed, real obviously, but...
Doesn't Brent have a mail on there?
Yeah, and Brent's got the mail, so...
Is this something that we can rent out in the future? I've heard stories of people camping out there, and some of the stories are funny.
Yeah.
Not very many camp there, but I talked with Elizabeth Finley Tanner, who was born in this cabin, and Lynn F. was born in the cabin. So those two really have some reason.
That's great.
I think assist in doing it, and I think that whether they should be allowed to spend 1 week in the cabin. So, because it's going to be used that you're talking about.
Possibly in the future, beyond that, they'll have it be kind of more of a historical museum place that people could walk through and see implements or treasures that have been found at their springs or any other history that can go down.
I've had people that have researched cabins and said they, a long time ago they spent the night down there, mm-hmm. and a weekend down in that cabin and stuff, and they excited about it, so.
Count the stars through the...
No, there's no food that night from there.
Don't even go there.
Yeah. Del Hamlin's cabin is pretty much too far gone, but... It's another cabin that was intact when we bought the ranch. It wasn't intact, but the walls were there.
And there may be other structures around that we might buy or steal.
Why not pick the barn?
And part of the workshop information is to determine at what point the materials are too far gone to. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so back to the regular agenda. Item 7, Ben's item. I don't know that he has a lot to update, but he did give me a couple of things, and I'll let Paul talk about the follow-up tests on the culinary system a little bit.
So the follow-up test came back good.
Maybe give him a little bit of background on, that we had a failure and what put us into.
Our last quarter, I had to test in, and they came back positive for coliform. Looking at what I've done in the past and what I did that day, nothing's changed. So I looked at kind of the situation that was there, and what had happened is the cows figured out how to turn the hydrant on, which made a big flood. I go to shut it off. A couple days later, the hose is still on the ground. Water backfed down into the well. But I went to take the test.
Mm-hmm.
I went to that class. I learned a whole bunch of stuff. I'll tell you about that in my report. But the test came back positive for coliform. What I didn't know, and I called Barbara Button on this, when you get a positive test, you're supposed to follow up with 5 tests that same month. Two before where you tested positive, 2 after, and 1 where the source was. I called Barbara Button. She told me, just take one in. Within 3 days, I took one. We got these letters. I think you guys saw the letters, but we got letters saying, that our system is a 100-point system, and they docked us 45 points, I think. So we have to post somewhere, probably on the internet, that we did test positive for coliform on the other system. But since then, we took tests back, and everything's come back fine. I've chlorinated the system. That's something in the future that I'm going to do probably twice a year is chlorinate that tank and the whole system all the way down to headquarters. But nitrate test came back good. Everything's come back good. So we just have to sit on these points for...
So you say that was contaminated by water siphoning back in because we have loose hole. Well, can't we put anti-siphon valve on these things?
Brent's told me years ago that there was anti-siphon valves on every hydrant, but people take them off and they get some of them freeze and break. Since then, I was going to wait for my report, but. Terry from the Rural Water Division came down and he pointed out a whole bunch of things that we should do. So if the county comes, they're not going to dock us points. And one of the things was anti-siphon valves on all the hydrants.
Well, I know there's a lot of different kinds of anti-siphon valves, and there's some very inexpensive that basically screw onto the pumps.
Yeah. $12.
Yeah.
But the problem out there this time of year is them freezing.
Yeah.
If you have them on a freeze-proof hydrant,
if there's no water in it, it can't freeze.
It keeps the water just right in the head.
It won't let it down.
I understand now. Those drain themselves.
What I've done is I put one on the fill station.
Yeah.
Where the Dershowitz water holds. Put one there. That's where everybody fills up from. My kids know not to leave the hose in the water, or not to leave it on the ground when they're done. Disconnect the hose.
But we did buy them to put on the cabins and to put everywhere.
Bought two.
So.
Because I returned those ones.
Okay.
Well, does anybody?
I'm gonna end up buying them all.
Does anybody know if they make one that would work underground?
Yes, they do.
They do. Mm-hmm.
And so in
exactly
the future, we should on the pressure side of the hydrant. Have an anti-siphon put in there, and so there's probably that and about 50 other things that Paul has that he's going to have to work through as he's learning, and we'll let Paul give a full report of that in his manager's report, but your observation is definitely correct. We would have had an anti-siphon, wouldn't have that failure. More than likely.
That's
so,
prevention's worth a pound.
Good update there. The other item, Ben, and again, we'll need to then talk about this when we do our budget, but he did get updates on coatings for the air strip water tank. The water tank inside the tank needs to be coated. It's the coating that was on it for whatever reason is flaking off, maybe mostly all gone, but it needs to be sanded and dealt with. And he got four bids on doing the redoing the tank. We might need to talk about who would do best, but I'll read what the bids are. One was $15,600. One was $19,404. One was $49,880. And one was $16,500. So three of the bids were pretty close, from $15,000 to $19,000, and one was in outer space bill.
Inside and out.
This, I think, is just
inside.
I talked to a number of people, and they said the outside is almost as good as the
inside. The one here does have an exterior. The cheapest one has an exterior abrasive glass and brush. Two coats of some kind of paint. So, so, and that's Kerry Houston.
Are they licensed one? All three of the long things?
Here's the four names.
Yeah.
Kerry Houston, Paint, Platoon, Amtech, they were the high ones, and Golden West. So, anyway, it's time for research, but I think for today's meeting, what I've pressed is I need some budget numbers. And so, you know, we'll need to do some evaluation, judgment to determine if we use these or even if there might be a better option. But it looks like, at least from a budget standpoint, we probably have enough data to show that we need somewhere in that $16,000 to $19,000 to make this happen.
What type of material is that?
Epoxy double coat.
Yeah. Epoxy. Is this the number?
Richard Coffin did the last interior.
Sandblasting.
Yeah, he sandblasted and coated it, yes.
What was that? Because Vance had worked up a plan on doing that that he presented last year.
It was in the 15,000 range.
I just had a thought, and I don't even know if it would work now. I'd have to make a call on it and see, but we use a waterproofing product in pools, and we use them in some of the aquariums that are it's fish friendly, like some of the state stuff. We use it in there because they've got some sea life in there, like turtles and what have you, that you can't put just anything in there to kill them. And it's a product called Aquafin. It's a elastomeric that's in it, and it's a cementitious product, and it really works well, and I find that it sticks about anything. It sticks to something nothing wants to stick to is PVC pipe, and this stuff does stick to PVC pipe, and it sticks to metal as well, as long as the surface is, has a like a sandpaper-like finish on it, it adheres to it. I'd be willing to talk to the German product, and I'd be willing to talk to a man named Alfred Kessie back in Chicago, that's my supplier, and just see if they've done anything like this. It wouldn't cost anywhere near that much. It's a, I buy it for about $140 a unit, and two coats of it will get me about 140 square feet.
If you would take the action item to look into that, and let's get another comparable.
How does that handle with temperatures?
Temperature? Well, the temperatures is not going to hurt it. We it's used in pools where the temperature can be, you know, we do an all-tile spa and put it in it. The temperatures go up there usually about 105 degrees. I don't think it'd be affected either by cold, but I can ask that question.
The pools would have chlorine, so
yeah, mm-hmm. They have the chemicals in it.
Lots of chemicals. Oh, besides
and the stuff really works well. I've switched over.
So this is called Aquafin.
Aquafin 2KM.
Application temperatures when we have to do it.
Any cementitious product, you want to apply it above 50 degrees.
Right. Okay.
But let's look into that. And
I know Ben's a chairman of the water resources and stuff. Is there a committee? I know. Yeah, your letter stated that there was a committee formed for water resources and stuff. In your letter to John Southwick, when we were looking at the Lute Spring project. Is there a committee of you and Vance, or is it just Ben? Or?
I don't know. The old committees were all abandoned, so you're in the process of setting up new committees right now.
Oh, okay. All
right. Am I up for consideration in that committee? Because I've asked twice about it now.
To help on it. Yeah, you did ask to help Ben.
Right. In fact, I asked Ben about you specifically. He thought somebody was going to be contacting him, which never happened. I can't remember who.
Justin.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, he's waiting for calls and anxious to have participants. So
okay, well, I would be the one. Justin doesn't have the time, But yes, I'm on board with that.
Phone number 689-0250.
0250 is Ben.
Mm-hmm.
I did email him. I didn't get a reply back, so try that one.
The reason I
asked
is that
435?
Right.
Now, do we need to
formalize?
Yeah.
He's looking for help. Colin, work with him. And if he needs to formalize something, he'll bring it back to the next board meeting.
In the meantime, could I be put on the call list for anything that happens with, so I can learn this as we go? Instead of having to play catch up later?
I don't know that we have some call list. Right now we have Ben working on Robert. You can call him and bug him every day if you want to. And see how much
he'd like
he
that.
Will call him.
Yeah, okay, I'll do that.
So, never pays to miss a meeting, does it?
Yeah. So anyhow, I would just say he's the guy you need to talk to about that. We have talked about Leaf Springs a couple of times. I took a well driller up there to look at it. Larry's tried to look at it. I think, you know, there needs to be some organized development of Leaf Springs. And so that would be the way to go about it, is to try to work with them and see what can happen there. So that would be good.
Sir, can I ask a couple of questions? How long are we in? How long did it last?
My understanding is it didn't last because it was done improperly or something like that, not because it wore out. But the tank was put in 6 years ago, seven?
Ten.
Ten. And I think it's been bad since day one.
Generally, when you're applying anything to, whether it's a substrate or a metal, if it isn't prepared properly, it is not going to hold. And we've had guys that try to use that stuff in swimming pools, and it lasts a few years, and it goes away. In due time, it's just going to delaminate. And epoxies are very stiff. They're not, you know, they're a rigid material. They're not very flexible. I mean, if you put it around a fiberglass thing, it has some flexibility, but the epoxy itself is not that flexible. Some of your polymers are flexible, and they tend to hold up better.
I think the tanks that the Water Conservancy is dealing with, I could be wrong, but once they're put in and sealed, we're just doing one right now. There's not an expectation that it's not going to last for 30 to 50 years. But,
mm-hmm.
So, in fact, I did find one 32,000 gallon tank that I could probably get through the conservancy that apparently is already sealed as another option. And I'm doing a little research on that. Maybe there'd be some better place that would use it. But they want $8,000 for that tank, and so if we can think of a place where that makes sense or whatever. But we can kind of maybe spend some time with them on some of the recommendations. But for the most part, what I've seen with their coatings is they're more in this $44,000 guy's price range. Maybe that's because it's a government job.
So what you're saying is that we could actually have access to a 32,000 gallon tank for it's already sealed for $8,000. Or we can put $15,000 into an existing tank.
Well, and so I'm getting the dimensions and some of the information.
Oh, okay.
And we haven't inspected the inside of this tank yet.
Oh, okay.
It's basically a tank that's going to be replaced with a big concrete tank. I'll have more information on it next week. But I told the Water Conservancy, anytime they come across some of these replacement tanks, we'd like to be
in the loop.
In the loop and know kind of what the cost would be and stuff. And so I'll have more specifications coming on that, and my guess is that you know, we'll always have a need for a good tank somewhere if we can get it at a reasonable price. A lot of them that we replaced up on Cedar Mountain were also a real nice size where you could put it on a flatbed trailer and haul them off. And this one also is a long tank, you know, sitting down horizontally in a frame, a framework of some kind. And so I don't know if the framework comes with that or not and what the details of all that are. I just got the call this morning. But we'll get more information. But I think for now we can say, and my understanding is even over the last 2 or 3 years, there's never been a situation that we found that was better than kind of this $15,000-$16,000 price range. And so we probably ought to budget for it, or at least put it in our draft. Next month's meeting, we'll do a final budget. We're just trying to do a draft, and perhaps in between then we can find out more about this Aquafin material and get an estimate there. And that's probably about all that we can make decision on today. But that could be a real good thing to research.
If they're going to work, and I'll talk to Alfred, you know.
Yeah.
If they've used it in that application, it would be good.
And through the Water Conservancy, we also have some real good resources with the state drinking water and so forth. And so if we have some specifications, we can run it through them and say, and they tell
well, I can get that.
Anything, so.
That specification on it. If I were going to build a water tank, we'll say I could build a concrete one or even out of block up there and use the fiber in it to reinforce it, because we have the cold joints in it when you do it out of block, and you put that stuff on and you put it about 3 coats of it or anything that you're going at a depth of about 7 feet or more. And it does hold, it can stop that from leaking. It will adhere to concrete very well. But I find it sticks to other things very well too. And just give me a thought there tonight.
Yeah.
And it just may be that that these Germans have got something here.
It sticks to KVC, that's pretty good.
Yeah. I've used a lot of Laticrete products that won't stick to PVC, and a lot of other things that won't stick to PVC. For waterproofing, I've had to use some mastics to go in there that would stick to it and create an O-ring. But with this stuff, I don't have to bother with that. And when I go around a penetration then, and I use a special cloth material that goes with it that gives it a strength from any vibration that might come, like in pool equipment, you have a certain amount of vibration just from the water coming through, and it breaks, it, over time it breaks down just from the vibration alone, and that's where your leaks develop. And of course that's what I do in water features, and I got to waterproof them, and I do them on 35 story buildings, and if it leaks up there, I got a problem.
You're in trouble.
The tank dimensions 13 by 42.
Okay. See, it isn't going to take that much to do it. It'll take more work to sandblast that and get it prepped than it will to apply the stuff. You can roll it on or shoot it on. I shot 15,000 square feet on a pool in 4 hours on one pool with the gun that we have. And
what about using the bladder?
We checked into that rather extensively when we started talking about this a couple of years ago, and it's not an outside the realm of doing it. The problem is that the expense of some of the bladders, or the bladder that we would need to actually collapse and as the water came in and out and everything. They're pretty spendy. They're in most cases more spendy than a new tank would be. and so we did look at that.
That's cost prohibitive. Yeah.
They're made of all sorts of different material, but I'll have to look back at some of my notes. I didn't even think about bringing that stuff, but Vance Green and I, we both researched it, and they're kind of it's kind of like a PVC rubber thing, almost like a rubber raft material, it pretty much would have to be custom built for our tank. And that's, you custom build something for something, and then the price goes up. If we could just find one that was, say, a 30,000 gallon bladder that would fit roughly into the tank, and then we could just start using it type thing, it probably wouldn't be that bad.
The only problem with that is, too, on the bladder, it has to be something that can, that won't break down chlorine to use it.
That's why I was asking, because we use PVC, we use thermoplastic, which is a TPO, it's a different material, and then we use ECDM, which is rubber, like inner tube rubber.
Right.
And we can do, that's what roofs are made out of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it leaves a nasty taste in water.
Well, or chlorine covers up the nasty taste, but anyway, that was my question, because if we're talking about the same thing, that's what I do. And it's just a matter of getting material inside the tank, welding what we can, and then it can be guaranteed to 20 years on a roof with ultraviolet rays that break it down. I don't know what it would be like, but if it's the same material these guys are doing that they custom build in their shop and then ship out to where the tank is, it would be the same thing.
Let me go back and look at my notes, and I'll email you what I
kind of. It's apples for apples. If they're talking about TPO or PVC or whatever it is, there may or may not be tape in it.
Six
months or whatever it is, and then there's no difference. And elastomeric lining is what we're using anyway, and so kind of like, or an epoxy or whatever.
Right.
Yeah,
we'll give you that assignment to research that option.
Okay.
Any other water issues?
Good.
Yeah.
Okay, next item. Agriculture, I'll give you an update on that. Johnson Seeding, we handed out last week plan on where they were going to seed. They have spent about $4,500 of the seed, and so they have another $500 remaining that we're going to give them. They probably spent maybe another $1,500, is my understanding, maybe $2,000 above that. But we made it clear to them that we were only going to commit to $5,000. But they do have a lot of the areas finished, and if you go in, particularly the ranch entrance, they've really worked that area over quite nicely, even with a land plane, to get it prepared. That's where we're going to do our main test part for the 4-H kochia, which they have bought and they're holding in a refrigerator because it's a live seed, and it dies off if it's exposed to heat. But that has to be planted when it is cold enough that it will not germinate until in the spring, or the winter will kill it. And so they're, I think, aware of all the conditions of how to plant it and set to do that. So that should be a really pretty entrance and a functional entrance, and something that gives us some fire protection and good forage as well. So, Sean?
I have that metal thing that we made out of by our pond. Is there something like, maybe I could buy some of the seed and put it over there at the same time?
I can tell you where to get the seed. I don't know that we want to...
Well, delve into that, that's fine.
Be buying seed from Johnson's, but there's two or three places. I bought some that I'm going to plant myself this year on my farm and, see how it goes. Carl Heaton up in Alton's planted quite a lot of it, and the BLM's planted a lot of it in the burn areas on this Milford Flat fire.
And what's the name of it?
4-H kochia.